Welcome to the Sunday Times Politics Weekly. My name is Khotatso Madisa, and today I'm joined by the ANC spokesperson, Zuko Godlimbi, who wears another hat of Deputy Minister of Trade and Industry and Competition.
I will not renew my membership of the EFF. I also request to resign all positions in the EFF.
We are not going to have a parallel government run by Helen Zille. There's one president here, and that president is Cyril Ramaphosa.
Bavas J.
Marikana. Marikana.
Bavas J.
Honorable members, be in order.
Those who are involved in state capture, actually retaken.
Does that include the top seven?
No.
Why does it not?
Don't start trouble. Nobody's going to announce tomorrow. The results are not correct. If that happens, people will be provoking.
You're dealing with Jacob Zuma. Every stage is a theater for him.
The people of Palestine, they're denied the right to enjoy the freedoms we so love.
Who are blown but not out.
You are playing quite a lot of roles. You are at NEC, now NWC, but I guess by virtue of being a spokesman,
by
or are you already?
By invitation.
By
yes.
Invitation.
Yes.
How are you? How are you coping?
Hey, my guy, I'm coping because I'm still standing.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work on both fronts. The spokesperson of the ANC is actually a very full-time job. You guys, you send media queries by 5 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah.
Some media interviews are scheduled for, you know, 5 past 10 or 10 past 10 in the evening. So I get very little reprieve in between. And I still have to competently do my work in government as well. So my day looks crazy. I have to try balance the two diaries of Luthuli House and the one of government as deputy minister. But it's been a... An interesting learning curve. I've learned things about myself that I didn't think I was capable of pulling off.
Mm.
So yeah, it's been that. It's working out.
There's something that is very popular in the ANC. Mzabalazo songs. I don't remember seeing you leading a Mzabalazo song since. Is that something that you do maybe when we're not there?
You can hear my voice is a bit coarse, so
yeah.
It would be an embarrassing attempt. I mean, I do sing. Those who grew up with me in the student movement and the youth league would attest that I do sing at times.
But you don't lead it. You don't
I've not led a song in many, many years.
What would you say is your favorite Mzabalazo? The one that you'd say resonates with you? I'm putting you on the spot here.
Yeah, no, yeah. There's quite a lot of them. Because I love music generally, okay. As a general rule. So that includes liking these songs as well. But the ones that I love are related. I think they are the ones that really come during the height of the struggle period. And they mostly have to do with Oliver Tambo for obvious reasons. I think there's a...
There's this one, Bambi Sandra Sab. Uju.
Yeah. I love that one as well. It could be pretty much the one that I love the most, in fact. But of course... I also love high tempo song.
Okay.
You know, I also
love
high tempo song. There's one that says Oliver Molo Sosha. Oliver Tina Sikotiwekai. So Sabalazo. Yes, because it sort of takes you into the context of the MK volunteers and how they were saluting the leadership of the ANC. And the meaning of literally abandoning your home and going to set yourselves up in exile as a military formation, whose intention, of course, is to liberate the home front. And then the song, of course, says, Oliver Molo Sosha, Oliver Tina Sikotiwekai. So although some of them were not literally expelled by decree of the law, but the situation literally forced them to abandon home.
Mm.
But... here you have people who've risked everything they have singing with such high spirit and a sense of passionate joy. But the message is one of dislocation. So that song, it really does touch. It could very well be that Oliver Tambo is also my homeboy. So maybe there's that.
That's why you resonate more with the songs that speak about him. But in the context of South Africa today, do you feel or think that such songs are still meaningful?
I think they are as a canon of memory and a way for us to constantly remember that what we have is a product of huge sacrifices that we almost know nothing about. And therefore, through the medium of the songs as an art form, it's also then, you know, a library of these feelings that I'm talking about. I wasn't there in 1961, I wasn't there in 76, but when you listen to particular songs that those who were there were singing, it sort of almost takes you into the moment in the context of their time and probably to one way or the other feel some of the things that they were feeling. But there is also then the question that because songs and all art reflects the struggles of the moment and the feelings of that moment, we should also be producing new songs.
Okay.
That are reflective of where we are, so that we could record for future generations an understanding of the political and social anxieties of present-day South Africa. Take, for instance, there was a song that Kosatu sang about Oliver Tambo in the mid-2000s. Towards the 2010s, which was also reflective of the problems of the moment. So the song says, Oliver Tambo, Baphela Bantu. So yes, we are talking about Oliver Tambo, who died in 1993, but it was sort of like an appeal to the idea and memory of Oliver Tambo in relation to the problems of the day. Mm-hmm. So it goes, Oliver Tambo, Baphela Bantu, bias retrencher, bias casualizer. Ah. Oliver Tambo baphela bantu. And in that way, you are taking the politics and struggles of the day and you are locating them to this heritage of struggle that is personified by Oliver Tambo, because you are then saying there was a promise of democracy and freedom that was exemplified by Oliver Tambo. What would be the ethics of a post-apartheid South Africa? Mm-hmm. So there were those expectations. And then that feeling of neglect, abandonment that the workers were feeling is then articulated in song by appealing to Oliver Tambo's memory. Whatever you think about the politics of them, of that, but the fact that it is registered in song then tells you about the importance of art in capturing, you know, the dynamics of the day. So as I talk about the song now, I actually do realize that actually the politics of the period 2000 to at least 2010 were essentially about the treatment action campaign for expanded access to antiretroviral treatment. It was about resisting the casualization of the labor market. It was about pushing back against retrenchments, as especially around the 2008 global financial crisis when the economy was being decimated. Then the song registers that. So that's the importance of songs.
Of songs.
Yes.
You then move post-2010.
Sure.
The party itself starts, you know, losing support one way or the other.
Sure.
Even the people who you want to attract into the movement, the younger generations, can't resonate with these old songs. So perhaps it's something that you guys should have done to say, okay, maybe let's create new songs that can help us even attract these youngsters. Because I mean, someone who's in varsity doing first, second year now, if you say to them, you are singing a song that, you know, that resonates with the period of 76, they don't know what you're talking about.
Sure, but I mean, you can still, that's the nice thing about struggle songs. You can keep the structure of the song and just sort of rearticulate the substance of it. Mm-hmm. So what goes into the lyrics. Let's take the Fuse Must Fall period. I mean, most of the songs that were sung there were songs that came from the old canon, but the messaging in the songs was reflective of the Fuse Must Fall problems that they were dealing with, you know? So the problem is not so much the structure of the song or the tempo of the song or the tenor of the song. It's more about what contemporary problem are you articulating through this song.
Through this song.
So regardless of age, people know their problems. If someone were to, okay, we've now passed load shedding, so I can make an example about load shedding. If someone were to take a song, even if you take the song that says, Sabashia bazalika yasavu masangena gumanya mazu, it might not make sense to, you know, a person now, but if you take the same structure of the song and
change the lyrics
and you talk about load shedding, and everybody was affected by load shedding would suddenly say, I can sing that song because it conveys my message. But just also to say that songs emerge in the context of struggle. Songs usually emerge from those who are engaged in an effort to bring about social change, whether it's through a strike action, or a protest, or a sit-in, or whatever. So that joint action of struggle creates bonds of solidarity that are sometimes best captured in a song or a painting. You know, so that's the role of the art. Art emerges in the context of some political action that is being engaged in. I mean, I'm not a 2K as such, but also I'm a child by all accounts. So I got attracted to politics in the late 2000s as well. That's when I went to varsity, where then the intensity of my activism was cultivated. So I still love these songs. They appeal to me and some members of my generation, regardless of the fact that we were not there, because I don't buy into this idea that the only way to attract the youth to politics is through fun.
Okay.
It's not true.
Because that's
it's
why
true.
I wanted to go around what attracted you. Yes. As you say, you're not necessarily 2K, but you are young.
But I'm young,
what
yes.
would have attracted you to ANC? And where can you trace your love?
My love for this
for
thing.
Politics in general, but for politics of the African National
of the African
Congress.
National Congress.
If you're saying it wasn't through fun. And
no, it wasn't through fun. And I think it's to suggest that, because, you know, young people are quite dynamic. We can engage in protest action during the day and go clubbing at night. And that's the whole point about being a human being. You don't have to be one thing. You can be many things. There are too many dimensions to what you are and how you engage your social agency as well. So I think the youth, for instance, unemployment is a massive problem. So young people can easily be brought into political action around campaigns related to solving the unemployment problem. Although young people do drink, they also recognize the negative impact of alcoholism when it goes to that level. The problem of crime in communities is associated with drug abuse. The youth is very much aware. They are both victims and perpetrators of violent discourses. So they are keenly aware. They could easily be drawn into politics if there are campaigns that are around those issues. So what happened with me? How did I end up in politics? It's a curious thing to pinpoint when and how, but I do recognize that being born around the transition period means that we grew up in a setting where the domineering personality of President Nelson Mandela was a thing that you couldn't escape.
Yeah.
And so I do suspect that that could be the first drawing card, that it's Nelson Mandela and ANC are almost one all the same thing. In how they are represented. But there was also, if you watch the news and you are curious enough as a kid, you then get to hear some of the things that are being spoken about South Africa's transition and so on, and what that means and what tasks lie ahead for the country to make it a better world in which all of us can pursue all manner of opportunities regardless of race and so on. So as you listen to that messaging, you then start to have your own imagination being framed in particular ways. So I was attracted into politics, I think the one moment that shocked my senses the most was when the innocence of the ANC's leadership was broken. What am I talking about? The ANC had been a coherent political idea in public imagination until the run-up to the 2007 Polokwane Conference.
Of course.
So you then began to see that there are competing interpretations of what it means to be an ANC person and what it means to be an ANC leader. And there's all manner of pulling, pushing and pulling that happened. So at the time, I was still in high school, you know, so you suddenly get fascinated by this thing and then you attend youth league meetings. Uh-huh. And, you know, this thing is, I mean, like, okay, I mean, it's one ANC. Why is it so, you know, test to be inside here? And then from there, you get into varsity. Now, the varsity experience, I still think, was the most compelling one for me. So this is what happens. So I go to varsity. Of course, I'm a youth league person in the Eastern Cape. Sure. I go to Walter Sisulu University at the time. I'm a student, you know, BSc Mathematics. There's nothing related to politics that, you know, I'm doing here. But I have the youth league, you know, background at home. So when I see SASCO campaigning for, it was on the run-up to the 2009 election, so there was, you know, a lot of campaigning for the ANC that was happening. So I attend a SASCO branch general meeting. I have absolutely no clue what they are going to be talking about. Yeah. So I get in there, and then these SRC chaps are delivering a report from a meeting that they'd attended. Now, the report was the most astounding thing, if you ask me. I will never forget it.
Yeah.
Because it made me to realize that, you know, being a student doesn't mean you're a disempowered person. There's a lot of pushing that you can get. So what happens? This chap, they come. It's around February, so.
Okay.
So it's the late registration period. So these chaps come and they say, no, we just came back from a meeting with the vice chancellor and the senior management, and we negotiated an extension of the registration period.
Okay.
So these guys negotiated an extension of registration. Okay, fine. They then say, we also then tabled something that was referred to as special cases around registration. Right. What are these? Special cases are people who have debts. So returning students with debts. These guys have negotiated that these returning students must be allowed to register. Okay. How much could these debts be? The chaps say, we've negotiated with management that those who owe 10,000 rands and have registration money for this year must be allowed to register without settling the previous debt.
Sure.
Okay. We've negotiated that those who owe 20,000 rands must, those who owe, and these numbers keep escalating. And I'm thinking, what sort of student goes over and beyond their own academic enterprise
to assist
other students?
Yeah.
I remember I looked around at the people who were sitting next to me and I thought, am I the only one who's recognizing how shocking this whole thing is? So that basically told me that there's an entire community. Of course, this is a hall. This is an auditorium full of folks who all seem to be committed to the welfare of others, not just themselves. Mm. I thought, okay, I could join this community. You know, this is something that I would pretty much want to do. In fact, it was the first time I dealt with ANC politics in a way that was that directly involved. That was, because remember, I mean, I was young, so even around local government campaigns of 2006, I was just a kid who's, yeah, you know, I didn't really deal with substantive issues. But here I am now, I'm listening to people who are literally detailing life-changing interventions. Because they also spoke about those who are due for graduation, who are going to graduate, but they have debts.
They still have debt.
So basically say, let's get them to be allowed to register, but they can sign an acknowledgement of debt, get their certificates, go look for a job, and then get into an arrangement with the university to repay. I think that for me was the most, I remember I'm hardly 17 at the time, I'm just a 16-year-old boy. So it's like, this is amazing. You know, this is the sort of thing that you have to get involved in. So at a most basic level, that's how I got into this. And then from there, the rest is history. Because once I applied myself into an understanding of the dynamics of higher education, and SASCO has this thing that it says that higher education, so the university campus, is a microcosm of society, which means whatever structural fault lines of exclusion are prevalent in a university campus, it's reflective of the broader trends in society. Mm. So the students who are sitting with this pile of debt are coming from a particular social class. All of them are rural people, poor people, ill-prepared even by the high school system,
yeah,
getting to university. So when you are looking at the high failure rate, it's not the deficiencies of the person, but rather the entire pipeline that prepared them to get into here.
Yeah.
So that a student who comes from an impoverished background and a poor school is likely to fail. So the propensity of failure is higher for those ones than those who come from well-off high school. So you then get to basically interface with class dynamics playing themselves out in a university campus, with racial dynamics playing themselves out in a university campus, because social class formation in South Africa reflects racial dynamics
sure,
as well.
Sure.
If you are black, you are likely to be coming from a poor rural or a rural home, or from a working class township environment. And if you are white, your reality is completely different. And therefore, the education resources that you're exposed to are reflective of that background, and that therefore the struggles that must play out on campus take the same tone and tenor as the struggles that are playing out in broader society. From there, I threw myself heart and soul in radical literature. By the end of the year, I was known as even the opposition party people used to, when they talked to me, they used to say, "Hey, Marxist, how are you?"
Ah,
you know, because that's how
okay.
deep I had gone into the thing. So, yeah.
Oh, okay. So you, this is now in the Eastern Cape.
Yes.
By then you've decided that this is my path. I'm sure you get involved even in just ANC politics beyond the SRC,
and you, because you are now joining the branch of the ANC that is in the ward. It was Ward 6 in King Sabata Talinjabo sub-region, in Oar Tambo region at the time. So you basically just get dragged into, then you join, you know, the Young Communist League, the SACP. This is it. Oh, and at the time I had a Chris Hani t-shirt that was written "All Communists to the Front" here at the back, at the face of Chris Hani. So it was almost like it was my uniform. And I also had a beret. So before the beret thing became a thing, those who went to campus with me still call me by that, because that was my signature look on campus. I think I was in my MK imagination in my head, you know. So yeah,
that's the activism.
That's the
that
activism.
Was that attracted you into the ANC.
Yeah.
Do you still feel like it's there today?
Pockets of it are there, but I think there's room and necessity for the ANC to return fully to an activist politics. And you've asked me about this thing in a different way before, because of something that I said.
Yes.
I think that's what is mostly missing, the ability of the ANC, beyond the activism of the Youth League and SASCO on university campuses. We need to get back to a tradition of ANC branches in communities to be engaged in community campaigns.
Over and above just saying, because you have 100 members.
We have 100 members.
Then you're a branch in good standing.
As I'm saying, what drew me into politics was to find members of an organization resolving problems of the people, not deferring to government. They were not saying, "We'll talk to the Minister of Higher Education to sort of." They were saying, as members of SASCO, as students on campus, we've taken up the initiative to negotiate on behalf of these students and to threaten a strike action if some of these demands are not acceded to.
Sure.
And by the time SRC elections come, you've already built a rapport with students that you are actually an organization that services their interests every day, not periodically.
Not just during
election. By the time elections come, the ones you assisted in January, through those special cases to register and do whatever, they will know who got them onto campus. They will vote for you. So it's the same thing. The ANC cannot campaign on the eve of elections. It's got to campaign every day. And how does it campaign every day? It solves the problems of the people. If there are children who lose their parents, what do they eat every day? Who ensures that they still wash their uniform and go to school? Who ensures that they actually do attend school? Who knows what needs they have? An activist organization must build units that are interacting with those households. We can't just see students going to school and teachers going to school and not be interested in how the academic enterprise is going in the school. So that if there are gaps, we can reinforce. If we're in a rural school where the enrollment numbers are high, so the learner-to-teacher ratio is such that one teacher is probably 50. Sitting with 50, we almost can recognize that the ability of the teacher to provide individual support to each learner will be undercut a bit. So what do? We can actually mobilize some young folks who are competent in that particular subject to assist the teacher, whether it's on weekends or after school when they have time, to sort of reinforce and help on that front. It's just these basic things that I think we can start doing and that can reignite an activist culture within structures of our movement.
But why is it so difficult? Where did you guys as the ANC get it wrong? And obviously, you are one of the younger generations who have now made it into parliament. You've made it into the NEC. You are able to reflect on issues at a more national level. The ANC was known as an activist organization. Sure. So these things that you talk about were known. People were doing them. Maybe not at the heightened level. But I'm saying, why is it that you can't go back to that? Why is it so difficult?
There are two things roughly that I think explain this thing. In the 1994 National Conference of the ANC, if you get that political report, there's a section where President Mandela says, "We made the mistake of taking the best of our cadres into government and leaving the organization unattended."
Okay.
So the best capacity of the ANC was moved into the state, and then this side was... And because the activist ANC of the 50s, 70s, 80s was an ANC that was not in government. Mm. So all of its best cadres were activists on the ground. They were doing everyday community work as leaders of the ANC. Then once the democratization process kicked in, elections happened, most of them then got deployed into, you know, parliament, this and the other. And that played itself over and over again with successive elections. And the capacity of the ANC organizationally to sustain its activism on the ground was hampered on that front. But also I think the ANC overestimated the ability of transferring its activist personality into the state so that you can have an activist ANC in the state and no longer necessarily having the need to do the activism on the part of the organization. And I don't think it was anyone's particular fault. It's just the things that you recognize after some time. That, okay, maybe over time we lost this and the other. Now, here's the thing about organizations. Organizational culture and practice proceeds firstly from enforcement.
Okay.
It might automate over time. People take it for granted that, oh no, we all must wake up and do this and that because that's the order of things. But usually it starts off when there are enforced tasks that all members have no choice but to fulfill. So they start off as enforcement until they become the norm. So part of the problem is that we've pulled back on the enforcement front. There is no enforcement, strict enforcement, that says for you to be a recognized structure of the ANC, you must perform these activist tasks. It's this thing that you were teasing me about from that old video that circulated.
Sure.
The idea is that because the tendency has been to run the organization on the basis of membership statistics to determine its life, there has been no incentive or coercive instrument that forces people to go beyond the membership statistics. That is why a renewed ANC needs to start at the base level by enforcing an ethics of activism. By
but setting how do you enforce? How do you make sure that
it's
that
there
enforcement
in the
happens?
Constitution of the ANC?
Okay.
Rule 23 of the ANC Constitution, especially Rule 23.6, explains what a branch executive committee of the ANC ought to be doing. And Rule 23.8 elaborates more. Just that over time, the ANC just pretended as if that rule doesn't exist. Because the rule says a branch executive committee of the ANC must meet every, so bi-weekly.
Okay.
And it tells you what they must do. They must prepare reports for community meetings. Why? Because bi-monthly, they should be convening community meetings. Not the ward councillor. The ANC branch executive committee. So a branch executive committee of the ANC that does not call a community meeting is already in violation of the ANC constitution. A branch executive committee that does not meet bi-weekly or fortnightly,
fortnightly,
is in violation of the ANC constitution. But sometimes these branches don't know because it's not part of the membership guidelines that we send to them. To say when we assess the functionality of our structures, we'll be looking at your compliance with Rule
23
of the ANC Constitution. Now, of course, Rule 23 sets the bare minimum of what the functional branch should be. But you want to
go over and
the
above.
The guidelines must take you over and above. They must specify what are these community and service delivery issues that we want to talk about. Let's take now. We've dealt with load shedding, but we know that the greatest problem is load reduction. And what is one of the driving forces for that? It's illegal connections to transformers in townships. In the spirit of Rule 23, we should be saying all pieces of the ANC should run community campaigns to engage the communities to pull back from these illegal disconnections and educate them on what this means.
But will that not give you another problem?
Mm-hmm.
I understand
mm-hmm.
what you're saying, but people would say, because there's no jobs,
sure.
we build back rooms
sure.
in our yards
sure.
so that we can get a little bit more something
sure.
every month to
sure.
cater for our family.
Sure.
Now, if you're saying it's illegal, therefore sure. you need to disconnect,
sure.
what do you, what, how do you then incentivize
them? And that's what the process of struggle helps you with, KG. You have to talk to the people because sometimes you say, no, they are doing illegal things because you're not interacting with them to understand the underlying cause of them acting in that way. So it means if you have that conversation with them and they bring this argument to you that we're supplementing our household income by building back rooms, they are now forcing you to have realistic conversations about your local economic development strategy at that level of the seat. What are the patterns that are informing unemployment in our locality? Is it because we have a low rate of education, low levels of education, people don't have post-matric qualification, or you find that they actually do have post-matric qualifications, but there's just no local industry. So that helps the ANC to then realistically build a campaign that responds to that thing. So you can start off entering on a campaign of electricity, and you come out with a program that is related to economic development because that's what you got. But if you don't talk to the people, you will stand on a mountaintop and just go to town about illegal connections without understanding the underlying causes that leads them to do
but
that.
But does the ANC still see itself as that it's your role to do that, especially given the results for the 2024 national and provincial elections? Do you still believe it's your role to take up those discussions and those interventions?
Now more than ever. These elections communicated quite categorically what the ANC has to do if it is to keep itself alive as an organization. It has to get back to conversation with the people every day. It has to prove itself as an organization capable of solving problems of the people every day and not come back once in 5 years or not come back once in 2.5 years between local government elections and general election. It has to do this thing all the time. And it cannot, the organization cannot afford to defer to government and say the only people who must do things are what councillors or the MMCs and what. Those people in government must be reinforcing work that you are doing all the time.
Mm.
But also how you hold them accountable must be on the basis of a rolling program of action. It must be easy to see a lazy ward councillor or a lazy mayor because they are not positively reinforcing the work that the ANC is doing. But when the ANC is moribund and not doing anything, you can't tell what standard you are setting for a ward councillor to judge whether they are doing their work or not. As I was saying, in the context of Rule 23, if the ANC is calling community meetings and is holding BGMs bi-monthly, when the ward councillor is not doing the same, it's easy to tell who's not pulling their weight. If the ANC is pulling its weight and the councillor is not pulling its weight, then it's clear what to do. You know where the problem is.
Sure, but what needs to happen for the ANC? Do you feel like you've learned your lesson? Do you feel like it's possible now or there's still a lot more to do? Because someone was saying, we interviewed the Gauteng chairperson, Banyaza Lesufi, who said the posture of some and most in the ANC is not of that of people who just came back from an elections that battered them. It's people who are still behaving the same. Is that your analysis as well? What needs to happen?
Okay, that belongs to, it's the second part of my answer. The starting point for me is the organization cannot depend wholly on the feelings of its members.
Feelings?
Yes.
Okay.
If members feel like today we must be activists, then the organization is activist. If tomorrow they suddenly feel that we are lazy, then we don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
The organization must have its protocols that insist upon its members that this is how they should behave. So the activist ethic of the ANC must be cultivated through written rules.
Okay.
Everybody must know what implications are there if you don't do what you are supposed to do. So we have to be activists because we have to comply. If we don't comply, then that's how you set the foundation of cultivating a culture of activism. I think for me, that's the major problem. But fortunately, the National Executive Committee is currently on a national initiative of meeting all of our structures to discuss the state of the organization. And by the end of September, we would have had a National Executive Committee convened specifically for the state of the organization and what renewal steps should we be taking, including then revising our guidelines on how we measure the functionality of our structure. So it will come from there.
Okay.
Once we do that, it will force all of our members and our structures to start being activists, and we will know what to do with those who don't comply with that. And this is because the message from our structures on the ground is exactly what I'm telling you. Anyone who was on the campaign keeps saying the same thing. The people did not vote for us because they keep asking us, where were you all these 5 years? Why did you return now?
Mm.
The people didn't vote for us because of water problems, because of electricity problems, because of unemployment. So the message is quite clear what the issue is. Perceptions of corruption, and
is
elitist mentality. Because, sure. I mean, I'm just saying, once people start to say, you all are corrupt. So whether you've ever been corrupt or not, if the sentiment is now entrenched that all of you are corrupt, that perception is very strong. And pushing back against it means before you speak, they just say, we don't have that. So that requires a lot of work to deal with so that you push back and get people to understand that this is what you represent, not what they've come to understand to represent. Now, on the one about the posture, if the ANC was not in government after May 29, there will be nobody in the ANC who has funny ideas that we didn't lose election. But because the ANC was able to secure power even after being at 40%, that does have the unintended consequence of lulling some of our members into complacence. They assume that because the ANC is still the dominant political party in government, all is well.
Mm.
So you need to constantly be reminding comrades that, comrades, we're actually sitting at 50% of the electoral mandate. We lost.
Well, 40.
I'm saying 40% of the electoral mandate. We lost. Because winning is 50% plus one.
Mm.
So if you're sitting at 40%, you lost. But it's easy to understate that, because, you know, loss usually should be demonstrated by not being in office.
Mm-hmm.
But if you lose and you still remain pretty much in office and dominant, you can mislead yourself into, you know, moving with slow pace. I think that's what Panyaza was talking about.
So you have two sides.
Mm-hmm.
One, you lost,
mm-hmm.
but it can't really be felt because mm-hmm. you're still in power.
Mm-hmm.
But being in power is also good for you,
yes.
because you're able to
regain lost ground if you do better, if you do differently. And that's exactly the thing. But remember, you do better when you recognize that you are under siege. At least from a subjective party political point of view, you assume that being in this precarious position would force everybody to do better. But the doing better is not just those who are in government doing better on their own. Even those who are leading organizational structures on the ground must also be doing better. So you must have an improved performance of government, but also an improved presence of the organization in communities, so that people can appreciate the work and functionality of the ANC employees in government, but also the local branch that they deal with every day. They must have a clear sense that these people are working to regain our trust. If we don't get it right on that front, then we'll have major problems.
Would it have been better for the ANC to properly rebuild, for you guys to have taken a step back and said, you know what, we've lost elections, perhaps let's not force too much to govern, to still govern? Would it have been better for the rebuilding of the organization?
I don't think so. I don't subscribe to that proposition that the ANC would have done better by getting out. Because what was at stake was more than the ANC's subjective need to rebuild itself. And that question was teased, you know, do we leave this thing or not? But the major issue was that if you step out of the scene, which other political force can be the anchor point of national stability? And we needed to consider those and say, when you look at the electoral terrain, we are commanding 40%. We have 6 million of the electorate that said, we believe you guys must hold the fort. Once you step out of it and then something goes wrong, how are you going to rebuild? Because people would have said, well, we had given you 40% mandate to be the anchor point of whatever form of government is built in the interest of national stability, but you abdicated responsibility. We couldn't do that. But secondly, the ANC cannot afford to understate the strategic importance of state power in delivering social change. So even if you had 40% of the electorate, your rebuilding must also be tied to your capacity to change the lives of the people. You can't rebuild the ANC without intervening in changing the lives of the people. So that needed to be retained. So you secure state power in the interest of national stability, objectively speaking, because anything could have happened. If you look at the conversation of the political parties and their attitudes towards each other, the ANC was the one party that was willing to talk to everybody, because it pursues a non-sectarian attitude towards political stability. The other political parties drew a red line that says, I can't talk to Khutats. That's their starting point. So pull the ANC out of the equation, and then you are left with people who don't want to have a conversation with each other. Where would South Africa be today? Nobody knows. So that was the first point. You needed to do that to safeguard stability. But the second one is, the ANC's shortest route to recovery is to cultivate a new record of delivery and governance. That's how people are going to vote for you. But you don't do it in government alone. You start fixing also the organizational problems that led you to this pathetic performance that you had. Build a vibrant, campaigning, community-based activist ANC as your baseline, and then support its effectiveness with a visible program of action in government that connects with those struggles of the people that the branches of the ANC will be picking up. Yeah.
But maybe to take you back just a bit, you say it was important for you guys to remain in government, but you've been criticized heavily
mm-hmm.
by one of your tripartite alliance partners that this need to remain, to keep state power, mm-hmm. sort of compromised you, because now you had to get into bed with parties such as the DA. I mean, Solly Mapaila of the SACP has been hard hitting, especially on that point that you know, you compromised yourself.
Look, it's the nature of political discourse in moments of crisis. The National Liberation Movement that has lost its majority for the first time, our reaction to the moment and how to get ourselves out of it was not going to be uniform. Mm. So we are still going to have this debate for quite some time, internally and outside, about what options lay before us. And as I'm saying, the ANC's position was to proceed from the vantage point of guaranteeing national stability before you even think about the issue of securing state power as a subjective interest of the ANC. And the idea was that you've got to get all political parties to be mature enough to negotiate a stability agreement about the need for government to be formed as quickly as possible and as broadly inclusive as possible.
Okay.
The idea that the ANC should have pursued a sectarian course that excludes one section of the political system than the other is not a sustainable argument from where I'm sitting.
Okay.
And this is an argument I held even before Comrade Solly made any of his views. But it's a conversation that we are still going to have with the South African Communist Party. We did have an engagement with all of them. The Secretary General spoke at the Central Executive Committee of COSAT. The Secretary General spoke at the Central Committee of the SACP, and I was with him on that one. Makura was with him at the COSATU meeting, where essentially he outlined the strategic thinking of the NEC, of the ANC. And these presentations were broadly well received, but it doesn't mean then, you know, discourse is shut down. We will still continue engaging with them to converse our points about how we understand the moment, how we understand the tactical choices that lay before us, and what considerations were the most primary over others.
Do you think there's still room for that? I mean, others are even saying perhaps if the SACP is so unhappy with the ANC's decision, they should recall some of their members who are in the GNU, Government of National Unity Executive, and also perhaps consider leaving the tripartite alliance or even contesting elections on their own.
The SACP has been encouraged by left and right-wing detractors to abandon the alliance since 1990. So it's not a new thing. This thing that the SACP must... So those who are either irritated by it or those who are committed to a politics of socialism have variously said the SACP must walk. So it's not a new thing. I think by what you are saying, you are referring to the presser of the Youth League, the one about them recalling. No, so what the Youth League was doing was to say, as far as we are concerned, all of us are in this together. We need to find a collective way of making this thing work. And you will have to sustain your argument by demonstrating your unhappiness by taking this action. It was not so much an invitation for them to do it, but it was a polemical problematizing of the argument that why would you believe that all of us combined would be outmaneuvered by six people? If we have party cadres in government, we have ANC cadres in government, we have COSATU cadres in government, how can they be bamboozled by six people? Because the concern seems to be about six ministers of one political party in a cabinet of 32. In what world is 24 outmaneuvered by six? What is this anxiety that you have about these people? So that's the militant course that the Youth League took in addressing the matter. But it's still consistent with the ANC's overall attitude that says, we don't believe that being in a broad GNU with 10 political parties, we must dramatize the power of one party, especially if that party is not even a numerical majority by any account. So that's the take that the Youth League, it's always good. The Youth League's approach is to rattle the cage so that the conversation can be driven to its militant potentialities. Then all of us can walk back and say, okay. Mm. We hear the Youth League. Yeah. Look, this is the space that we're in. But from where we are sitting, Comrade Soli is holding the line of the general secretary of the party, and the party must have a militant attitude and political question. We will still debate the issue with them. There will be an alliance secretariat meeting and an alliance political council where these issues will be ventilated. More than the form of the GNU must be the issue of how do we sustain a progressive agenda as reflected in the ANC manifesto within the contested terrain of the GNU. And that's where the party is also going to provide us with valuable insights on how best to approach the issue.
So where you are sitting right now, they are well within their rights to be raising these issues in the manner that they are.
We can debate the manner of how they are raising them, but the party cannot be asked not to raise its views. Mm. It has never happened. It will never happen. I think the Secretary General also raised this thing when he was commenting on the matter, including in the press conference that we had. No. There will never be a moment where the ANC says the SACP must keep quiet.
Mm.
The SACP is not a sub-branch of the ANC. So they're an independent organization. They have to express their views. It doesn't mean we will always agree with them or the manner in which they raise the issues. But the issues are raised and we have to then find each other, sit down, talk them through, and eventually try to negotiate a common understanding that will be the basis of common action. That is what we want to do with them. Of course, in a highly sensational media environment, you guys, you love it when alliance partners seem to be engaged on a public brawl. And that's what then dramatizes the discourse. But it's par for the course. I can go to an SACP conference or a COSATU conference on behalf of the ANC and raise critical views about them. Inside, it does happen, you know. And they will not inherently be offended. They might even appreciate some of the things that I would be saying, as long as they are political and ideologically, you know, rooted, and I'm trying to challenge them to rethink their strategy. So it's part of the healthy discourse that plays out in the movement. Of course, but because we're in trouble, we would all love not to be engaging each other through the media and be talking in meeting context.
Sure.
And that's what we're still going to do. Rest assured, I don't think by December there will be any story to write about the SACP and the ANC not agreeing on the issue of the GNU. I think by then the matter would be properly settled and we'd all be working together. Well, yeah.
So what people say is that they're looking at this in the aspect of the question that keeps coming, that is the ANC dying? Is this, you know, this chat, this talking over each other, does it really speak to the ANC perhaps dying? What would you say to someone who comes to you and says?
So one of my favorite presidents of the ANC is President A.P. Khuma. The ANC constitution we have now is an elaboration of the template that he designed. So the ANC that has a national working committee, a full-time secretary general, provinces, structured the way they are, is a Khuma invention.
Okay.
He worked on it with Bram Fischer, who was a lawyer, because, you know, Khuma was a medical doctor. He probably didn't have the language of how constitutions must sound. But Khuma was elected president of the ANC when the ANC had been proclaimed dead after a disastrous period of the 1930s during the reign of President Pixley Kaisaka Seme. So the ANC was quite decimated. In fact, when you read the record, membership fees were not paid up. Even the membership, subscribed members were very, very low. In fact, even the Secretary General of the ANC, Reverend Canon James Talata, had almost given up on this thing that it could even be revived, you know. And President A.P. Khuma then came with some major, major organizational reforms. That is why I'm very much a fan of organizational reform, really, that the organization must be, there must be a redesign on how the organization functions, not rhetorically, but by changing the text of enforcement. Because that's what Khuma then did. Redesigned a new constitution, engaged in a nationwide traveling to engage prominent former leaders of the ANC to re-encourage them to come back to the ANC. And one of the major things they did after that was to work towards the African Claims Charter of 1943. Because then the issue was, so we're rebuilding this ANC on the basis of what major program? And then the African Claims Charter became that binding framework. And there was the All Africa Convention as well that he initiated the establishment of, because he needed to now start to demonstrate an ANC that is activist in orientation, that is responding to pressing challenges. And just to say that the African Claims Charter, incidentally, was not in itself a response to any major domestic thing.
Okay.
It was actually a response to the Atlantic Charter by the, so basically the organization that is the precursor of the United Nations.
Okay.
So they respond to that in order to build a uniting program of action for activists in South Africa. And that then sets the whole thing in motion. And what does he do? He then blesses the formation of the ANC Youth League in 1944. So what does that represent? The birth of the Youth League in as part of the organs of the ANC is another example of organizational renewal. Because you are now building new structures whose intention is to reconnect you with a particular social base that you need to mobilize. The fact that the Youth League in 1949 then is the one that led the charge against him doesn't take away that it actually is a reflection of his own genius in the theory of organizational development and redesign. I'm raising all of this to say whether the ANC dies now or does not depends on how we re-engage with the Khuma ethic of organizational redesign and redevelopment in a manner that is responsive to the problems of the time. The national dialogue that President Ramaphosa has been talking about is an opportunity to produce a similar binding program of action to the African Claims Charter. It need not be as international in its orientation. Yeah. So the ANC from Khuma goes on to produce the Freedom Charter, because Khuma had given us the blueprint of a charter. That's the African Claims Charter. Then the Freedom Charter, which is the most prominent one, came afterwards. Even after Khuma had left the scene, he was no longer president of the ANC. But his method of organizational redesign and the need for the organization to constantly negotiate social compacts over and above its own membership base is a template that the ANC has been running on the basis of. And if we get back into that tradition of how to recalibrate the ANC when it is almost dying, we'll get it right. But if we behave as if all is well, we just sit back and continue with life as usual, there are ministers in government, there are elected leaders, but we're greatly disconnected from society and we don't recognize that some of the ways in which we are organized have got to change in order for us to better engage with society, and that there's a need to regenerate a uniting vision on how to build a better South Africa. And that some form of social compact, whether it's called a national dialogue or whatever, it has got to be supported, and the ANC must play a leading role in convincing society that this thing is important, then the ANC might die. So the short of it is that the ANC might die or live depending on what it chooses to do.
On the question of its reform.
Its reform, yes.
And do you think it's possible?
It's possible. The conversations we're having are pointing to the fact that it's possible. Everybody, even if some people are doing it for fear of loss of state power, so be it. As long as they are going to come to the party and we all agree that let's rebuild the ANC in a manner that reconnects it with the people and gets the ANC to regenerate a vision that the people can buy into, and the ANC can improve its efficiency and regain its ethical high ground on how it conducts itself, how it conducts the affairs of state, we need to do that. If we don't do it, then there will be no reason for people to to recommit themselves to this thing. So people recommit themselves to a vision that is actionable. Mm. And we must demonstrate to them by acting every day in our branches, in our regions, in our provincial conduct, in the conduct of the National Executive Committee and how it communicates with South Africa and demonstrates an understanding of the major problems that the people of South Africa are faced with.
As we wrap up.
Sure.
So there was someone who said, are you worried that you are inheriting a dying party? So it goes back to this conversation. Sure. And someone in answering, I think answered for you, another one said, how do you say they're inheriting? You're speaking in future terms, they're already leaders
already
now. But I mean, the question is there. You're in the NEC mm. now, but you obviously see yourself somewhere, perhaps even within the ANC. Mm. But you would be inheriting, you are there now, you'd be inheriting a party that, you know, is a 40%, if it goes even lower, a 30%, even a 20% party. Mm. Does that keep you up at night?
Definitely, it keeps me and all of us up at night. But as I'm saying, the Xuma experience is also quite instructive. He didn't inherit an ANC of Josiah Gumede or Sfako Makhato that was broadly popular and strong, or of Seme himself that he inherited. He inherited an ANC that was on its knees. That provided him with an opportunity to emerge as one of the greatest leaders South Africa has ever seen, because he took the initiative to set the ANC on a course of renewal and rebirth. That's the challenge that history has unfortunately imposed on us who got elected in 2022 when the ANC was about to lose its maturity in 2024. But the signs had been there that the ANC would lose its majority if it doesn't change course. We'd been screaming about it for a long time, even when we were still in the youth league as very, very young, you know, hardly 20, you know. We already were writing about this thing. In fact, I do remember that in 2014, we wrote a discussion document for the Youth League National Congress, which actually predicted that the ANC would lose elections. I remember the former Deputy Secretary General, Umam Jesi, was not very happy with us for that. saying, where do you get off writing about this? Somebody was saying, no, but you know, DSG, we're not saying the ANC is going to lose. As a matter of fact, we're saying it's going to lose if it doesn't do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. By the way, that's the discussion document that first introduced the branch in good standing issue. We literally tested out that idea about an inventory of building an activist branch of
but
the
ANC. But that has not
happened.
That's
what I'm saying. So it's 10 years later now. So we called it 10 years ago in the youth league that it would happen. And it has happened 10 years later. Why? Because the ANC has not been moving on that. So it's quite clear that the ANC has got to do something if it is to rescue itself from electoral decline. But if it does not change course, then it won't do much. That's why I'm saying the Xuma example is instructive, because we know that the ANC has been rescued from the brink of collapse before by organizational redesign. In fact, 1969, the ANC faces a similar problem, because after the Rivonia arrests and the unbanning, and then the banning of the ANC sort of struggled to rebuild its structures and rebuild a strategic approach to how it will conduct the struggle. It had the 1967 Annie Memorandum was a product of that, to say we need to change course or we're doomed to die. 1969 Morogoro Conference sits and deals with those issues, including questions of organizational redesign. Okay. Because then that is when the ANC not only relied on a National Executive Committee, but it also produced something that was called the PMC, the Political Military Council. It also produced the RC, the Revolutionary Council, and all manner of other, you know, structural reforms that the ANC undertook to redesign itself, to respond to the terrain of exile, and to better coordinate its work. And that is how it was able over time to regain its upper hand as the most dominant liberation movement in the South African struggle. It was from a precipice of collapse as well. So it's not as though the ANC has not had these periods, but the key is, those of us who are the current leadership and membership of the ANC, are we able to learn any lessons from those previous instances where the ANC found itself in a similar position. And what do we do? Of course, in the current context of being a democratic society in government with an electoral cycle that comes every 2.5 years. So we don't have the luxury of time. We need to move with speed because the first test case of a renewed ANC will have to be the 2026 local government election. The first test case of whether our structures are community activist structures or not should be between now and 2026. Not 2026. By the time we get to 2026, it should be on the basis of an organizational program of action that demonstrates a responsive, activist, and campaigning ANC that is actively resolving the problems of the people in every locality. So that's the test. It's a challenge to us. It's not so much that we're inheriting a dying party. We are actually in a position where we can reemerge we can emerge in history as that generation of leaders that recalibrated the ANC. But it depends on what we do.
Thank you so much for that, Zuwene. I really appreciate the time you've given us. Your maybe as a parting shot, your former president, Thabo Mbeki, speaks, I'm trying to talk about practical terms. He speaks about the step aside resolution.
Sure.
And he says, people who wait until they are charged before they vacate positions, before they are in government or in the ANC, are not true ANC. Because the image of the ANC itself has been battered. And you, I mean, it's the elections are a result of that image. Is it something that you'd agree with, I mean, as a parting shot?
I think that of course, the step aside thing is a particular instrument of how to respond to a problem. But the general thing would be, because the ANC is standing in a very difficult position in terms of its ethical credentials in public imagination, all of us must think carefully about how our individual predicaments with the law tend to attach themselves to the integrity of the ANC as well. That's for me is the starting point. Whether there's a step aside thing or not is something else. Do I want to keep on representing the ANC publicly when I have particular problems? I always say, take the example of comrade Mike Mabuyakulu in KwaZulu-Natal. I think for me, he's probably the best example of how this thing works. So he gets charged. What does he do? He steps aside. And what happens? The court process plays out. He no longer has a case now in court. He's still our beloved comrade Mike. The sky didn't fall. But it didn't hang in when the ANC was being associated with this thing. So on that front, I think it's an example that we can go with. So I understand the point that President Mbeki is making, that the best thing that a comrade would do would be to say, hey, okay, because my name is now being dragged and the ANC's name is also then being dragged by an association, let me go deal with this thing, especially if you know that you are not guilty. You just go and deal with this thing. Whether you lose a position now or not doesn't change much because you will come back to the life of the ANC once you've dealt with those problems. So it's a point that all of us in the ANC have got to consider.
Whether or not you've been charged.
Whether or not you've been charged. If something grave is such that your everyday presence puts the ANC on a back foot, it might be the best course of action to say, let me attend to this thing on my own, and then I will come back to assume my position.
Is this
of course, the risk, is this
advice that you'd give to Minister of Justice now?
Well, I wouldn't want to get into the issue of who's the dealing with what, because it's a live issue. But that was just a general theoretical point about how I think would best do these things. The Minister of Justice is dealing with the issue. She's spoken to the President, as she has announced. She was in the portfolio committee earlier today. So she is dealing with the matter. That's also better than just digging to your heels. Then she still has to then make up her mind about what the next course of action is. So she did say she will deal with it. She spoke to the President. She accepted an invitation by the portfolio committee. From there, she now still needs to weigh the options as to what is the next course of action that she needs to take, including petitioning the ANC's Integrity Commission and talking to them, or the Secretary General. There are a lot of actions that we can take. She's already spoken to the SG. She's already indicated to the Integrity Commission. All of those are notable steps, but she still then needs to make up her mind about what is the best course of action going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, thank you. Thank you very much.